studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. I've been reading and enjoying the novel Night Film from author Marisha Pessel. I talked to her a few years back, and I thought it would be a good opportunity tonight to listen back to that show. When we spoke, Marisha Pessel had just published her excellent debut novel, Special Topics in Calamity Physics. That book's main character, Blue, was a high school senior with an encyclopedic knowledge of the cinema. Have you read any good books lately?
Oh my goodness, yes I have. I'm doing a lot of research for my second novel, so a lot of that is nonfiction. But let's see, what am I reading right now? I'm reading The Devil in the White City, and I'm also reading the latest Shabun, the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is fantastic. So I like to read a few books at the same time.
I sort of thought that. You must be some kind of speed reader.
Actually, I'm very slow, but I like to have a lot of books around me, especially when I'm on tour, as I am now, and, you know, wait, all those hours at the airport, you have to be immersed in different worlds, so it's nice to have a few books. Then that means I also carry a gigantic bag. I look a bit like a bag lady, but that's okay.
Well, before we start talking about your novel, you know, I already know that there's no easy answers because I saw the cliff notes on your website.
Right.
And I don't want to give away anything, you know, from your novel, so I'm going to let you take the lead on that and tell us, you know, tell us a little bit about Special Topics in Calamity Physics.
Well, it's if it has to ascribe to one genre, it would be, it's a literary mystery, and it's narrated by this bookish, painfully shy 17-year-old named Blue Van Meer. After her mother's violent death in a car accident when Blue was five, Blue and her father, Gareth, who is a charismatic Swiss-born political science professor, take off on an 11-year road trip while he works as a visiting lecturer at various obscure colleges all across America. And as a result of this nomadic life, Blue really has no friends to speak of beyond that of her father and these hundreds of books that he has to read. But everything changes when he decides that they'll reside in a single location, and they move to a remote mountain town in North Carolina. And it's there Blue begins to uncoil these many mysteries that surface around her, and ultimately the mystery of her own life.
Now, have you spent any time with 17-year-olds? I mean, are there any 17-year-olds that are like Blue Van Meer? Is it possible that any 17-year-old could be like her?
Well, of course. I mean, anything's possible. I mean, I did, when I set out to write a novel, it was very, it was important to me to create my own fictitious universe, populated with my own larger-than-life characters. And but Blue was really the beginning of the idea for Special Topics before I had any of the mystery elements, before I even had Gareth. I had a vision of this painfully shy person who really believes herself to be totally camouflaged by her environment, and yet, and she doesn't say much. I mean, people who meet Blue, at least in the outset of the novel, I mean, she sees herself as someone quite forgettable, and yet I wanted the juxtaposition of her inner life to be absolutely vibrant and almost boisterous, teeming with observations about the world around her and the people in her life. So I really began with that juxtaposition of a really shy person, that her exterior versus her interior, which is just bursting with life.
Right, so her inner mind is working constantly, whereas her voice is not.
Exactly. I remember reading some sort of how to write a novel book when I was in college, and one of the rules was that your protagonist had to speak a lot in a lot of the scenes, that he had to talk and articulate what his desires were, and I really just took the opposite route with Blue. I mean, often in some of the conversations at the outset of the novel, she says two words, but then, of course, she has this interior monologue, which is quite different than what she appears to be thinking.
Yeah, she's acutely aware of everything that's going on, even though she's not contributing to anything that's happening. Or she's
right.
Contributing by her presence, but not with her voice.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about your writing process. I mean, so you started by conceiving of the... I mean, it's a big book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your first novel. Is it your first published novel or your actual first novel?
Well, it's technically my third novel. I wrote two failed novels when I was in college. The first one was a sort of Dashiell Hammett knockoff. a whodunit, but it was really obvious on the fifth page who had done it. That made the next 300 pages really tedious. And then I wrote a Southern novel, which really had no plot whatsoever. This was something that I didn't plot it out. I just sort of wrote as I went along, and it ended up being just unreadable, you know, wandering around. Like, it just was so slow that I had to throw it away, because that made me realize in terms of my writing process that I have to plot things out. I have to know where my characters are going, so then I can relax when I'm actually doing the writing and worry just about, in Special Topics' case, being true to Blue's voice and how she would describe this world around her. Because I didn't have to worry about, oh, what's she going to discover? Also, when you're plotting a mystery, you have to be very scientific in terms of laying in those clues. Because if the reader, you have to remain five steps ahead of the reader, and the only way I can do that is to plot it out ahead of time.
Right, because otherwise you feel ripped off if there's just an answer for which there were no clues to begin with.
Exactly, and I certainly didn't want to deliver that sort of frustrating read. I like to, if I'm reading a mystery, I like to really be working actively to try to get ahead of the author. It's almost a competition, so I had to be on my toes.
We're talking with Marisha Pessel, and the novel we're talking about is Special Topics in Calamity Physics. So at what point in your planning did it become a mystery?
Well, this is so funny. It was always a mystery from the outset. I always wanted to write a mystery and have it unfold. And it just so happened that it unfolds in a way, even though Hannah Schneider's death is mentioned at the outset of the novel, it unfolds in a way that the reader is lulled into thinking this is simply a coming-of-age story, which I, of course, was unaware of. I thought that there was so much suspense on every page of the book, so that was a bit of a surprise for me, but... But it's very difficult when you're writing to know what the reader's experience is, someone who's coming to your novel cold, not knowing anything about it. And so that's something that I'll take away from my second book.
Well, and how much do you care about your reader? I mean, when you're writing, are you thinking, oh, what will my reader think? Or are you just thinking, I must make this art?
Well, basically, it's 50-50. Maybe as I get old, I hear as I get older, 50-50. 50% I have to write to please myself, 50%. Some sort of reader who is going to pick up the book. But I've heard that as you get older, it's more like 90-10, like you just want to please yourself. But I'm not quite like that yet.
Mm-hmm.
No, I do. I don't care so much about the reception, but I care about delivering an experience that at least some readers will feel is worthwhile, to give up an hour or two of their day to read your book. You want to deliver something that's worthwhile, worth not only the $26 that it costs, but... you have to transport the reader to a new world, introduce them to new characters. You know, that's what the great reading experience is. And I come at writing from a love of reading. So, you know, that feeling where you're just immersed in a book and you don't want to do anything else, and you're by the time that you finish the novel, you have a sense of loss. I mean, that's the great reading experience. And I, of course, want to try to deliver that to a reader.
Is there going to be a movie of Special Topics in Calamity Physics?
We did. We've optioned the film rights, to Scott Rudin, who's a fantastic producer. He did The Hours and The Queen. I mean, he just has really first-class taste and his fantastic literary adaptation. So I'm very excited about it. We're just in the beginning stages now, and I won't have... I mean, I'll be involved with it as much as they allow me to be. But
you won't be writing the screenplay personally?
No, I won't. No. I've moved on to different projects, but Scott Rudin has such great resources. I'm sure he can find someone who really can do the adaptation, and he wants to remain very true to Blue's voice and make sure that is that permeates the story. So I think it's in good hands. I really do.
Special Topics is self-referential, constantly about books and school and curriculum and all of that. Will that change? Will it be self-referential to film more with the film version of Special Topics?
No, I mean, I think that you can keep that literary quality. Wes Anderson comes to mind. I mean, he's a very bookish sort of filmmaker, actually. So, but it would have to be done in a really creative, new, fresh way. But I think you can keep that. I mean, obviously not to the extent. I mean, you have to. I mean, I don't quite have all the answers right now, but
there are no easy answers.
I think you. No, they're not. I think that you can convey that. But again, yes, you have to also, I mean, the experience of the book will always be its own thing. The experience of the movie, of course, will have to be something entirely different.
How long did, well, you say moved on? So, I mean, how long did you spend with Special Topics and Calamity Physics?
Well, the actual writing took, well, from the plotting, the germinating idea, to the finished draft was 3.5 years. But now, I mean...
And that was two years ago?
Final, yeah, I turned in that final draft 2 years ago.
Right.
So, it's funny, as a writer, you have different... when you look back on your characters, I mean, I've heard that for first novels, after you've read for them so many times that they become unbearable, but I have to admit, I still like my characters. And, but it's interesting, I mean, having a distance between between their inception and now when the world is commenting upon them. It's kind of, you sort of look at it with a certain remove. It's interesting. I haven't quite figured out what's happening with it, but...
Let me ask you a couple more questions about your process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you rewrite obsessively, or you plod through, or which is you?
Well, I think there is a level of obsession to all writers. I mean, the writing process itself is, you have to be obsessed to kind of give up a normal life to go into a room and sit alone. I mean, that does require a strange obsession. But I rewrite as I go along, and I definitely write in a linear fashion. I don't write chapter 16 before I write chapter 1, so I move in a linear fashion, especially in this case because Blue's voice does change over the course of the novel. She is always quoting, citing different texts and resources at the outset of the novel, but those thin over the course of her story. And so I just wanted to have her voice, as I changed as a writer, I wanted Blue's voice to have that transformation. So that's why I chose to do it in a straightforward way. And I just write one sentence. I feel as if I've conveyed the thought correctly, and then move on slowly to the next. I mean, it's a long sort of haul up Mount Kilimanjaro. but you do sort of enjoy, I mean, the creative process is intensely gratifying. So,
well, Blue Van Meer also provides us with visual aids, illustrations throughout the book, although they also thin out toward the end. Is there a reason?
There is a reason. Well, the visual aids came late in the writing process. Originally, it was up to the reader to conjure what Blue was talking about when she talked about visual aids, but my agent knew that I was sort of an amateur artist, and I had done a lot of pen and ink drawings which were hanging in my apartment, which she'd seen. So she suggested that I do a few drawings for the visual aids before we went out with the novel to Viking. So I did those rather quickly. But I want that last 200 pages of the novel, which really start the pace. I was very cognizant of, I wanted the pace to quicken. And so it just seemed that as Blue is sort of speeding through, connecting all of the dots, that both the references and all of that, all of those devices used in the beginning would thin out a little bit as she learns to simply trust her own voice and her own reasoning.
So you're controlling to a certain extent the reader's pace also?
As much as you can. I mean, again, it is sort of, I didn't have a lot of readers reading the text, so it is sort of a shot in the dark sometimes, trying to figure out what's going to be suspenseful. But in terms of pacing, just moving that action along, you can pretty much, you can handle that.
So when you wrote this novel, you were no longer a student, no longer working in workshops or things like that?
Well, the only workshop I ever took was playwriting. And yes, I had graduated in 2000 and took a job as a financial consultant at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and that was really when I began just the initial thought of writing a book about this father and daughter and how their relationship would change over the course of the novel. So I wrote half of it that first year and a half. I had a full-time job. And then I was able to quit and move to London, and I was living in London while I finished it. And then I moved with my husband back to New York, and that was when I started looking for a publisher.
The book was finished in London, and then you find a publisher.
I, Well, if you want to be technical about it, I think there was like 1 month in New York where I was just writing the last parts of the book. And then I started the research to find an agent, and because I knew that was going to be a long process, too.
Yeah. You know, I think, like, if people listen to Joni Mitchell and they hear her songs, they think, well, these are all songs about Joni Mitchell.
Uh-huh.
So how much of Marisha Pessel is in Blue Van Meer?
Well, I think the closest analogy you can think of is just an actor playing different parts. But well, I don't want to say, I was going to say Meryl Streep, but I don't know if I'm Meryl Streep. Maybe Julia Roberts playing many different roles. She's always a little bit Julia Roberts, even though she has so many different characters that she plays. Or Kate Blanchett.
Okay.
So you can become a chameleon as you write from, you have to become these other people, but they have to be different from you as well. I like to write beyond my own experience and from different points of view and different characters. So I would say all of my characters are me. I've simply augmented or diminished different aspects of my personality to be true to these characters and who they are, their biographies, their background.
So you're as much Gareth as you are Blue.
Definitely. Definitely. I'm as much Eva Brewster in One of the June Bugs as I am Violet Graisley, the admissions counselor.
The those other two characters that we mentioned, Blue and Gareth, and I guess a lot of other people in the story, and Hannah, mm-hmm. have read an extraordinary amount of books and seen an extraordinary amount of movies. You know, way more movies than the average 17-year-old could see, or the average, say, 28 or 29-year-old would see. Mm-hmm. But you must have seen them all or read them all.
Well, 90% of those references are made up. So the ones where...
Right, in the books, in the literary book references, you mean.
Right. The movies, though, I mean, I'm obviously a film buff, so I've sadly enough seen most of those.
Uh-huh.
I think I've probably seen all of them. I mean, I love screwball comedies. I mean, I think films, old movies, inform my fiction just as much as contemporary or classic literature does, because I see, as I'm writing, things very visually. And no, I do have a real soft spot for those old screwball comedies, Howard Hawks, and, you know, old 1940s film noir. I'm also a big fan, so... Again, even though your characters are separate from yourself, your own personal history manages to crop up inevitably.
We're talking to Marisha Pessel. Her novel is Special Topics in Calamity Physics. Your biography, let me just share it with the folks at home. Here's what it says on the Marisha Pessel's biography in her dust jacket. She grew up in Asheville, North Carolina, and now lives in New York. This is her first novel. Is there more to your story?
Not really. That's it.
Tell us a little bit about you. When did you start writing?
Well, I began writing probably when I was 6 or 7, and my mom had an old Smith Corona typewriter, and I remember writing my first stories on that. My mom also was an amateur writer and herself, so she was always writing and reading out loud to my sister and I. So we grew up in a very book-friendly family, and as just an offshoot of that, I began writing my own stories, and they were really bad, obviously. And then I wrote all through high school, and but again, I didn't really think I could be a published novelist. I hadn't really made that commitment. But writing was just something I did in secret and in my spare time, really, whenever I had a spare moment.
And when you went to college, was writing your thing?
Well, I was also acting a lot, and I thought I wanted to be an actress, and I was writing, and so I think. I knew I had to choose between acting and writing, and I just realized after a few misfires with a few New York casting directors, I realized I'm so much happier alone in a room writing a story and living with these characters and trying to tell a story, just good old-fashioned storytelling, which is what I grew up with, and so that was really where I was happiest.
Well, I guess if you're an actress, an actor, you're only as good as the worst actor in your play.
That's a good point. No one ever put it like that. Or you're only as good as the really bad dialogue that you're reciting for a commercial, yeah.
Right. Whereas in your novel, it's all you. You get to play all the parts. And
exactly. And it's as good or as much of a success or a failure as you make it.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with that. And your fate is in your own hands, which is was sort of a relief
and
after
it goes,
going in those casting sessions. And
right.
I also, yeah, it was just I'm very shy, so I think just it was difficult for me to meet so many strangers and try to sell myself because I really don't want to sell myself at all.
Well, of course, now you're touring around the country and reading your book. You're doing readings and signing books and meeting tons of people who love your book. And is that difficult because you're shy?
No, it isn't. Because it's really about the book. I mean, I'm sort of ancillary to that. But it's actually fantastic, especially now with the paperback tour, because I get to meet readers who've read the book and just to see how people do take literature seriously and books are important to them. And that's nice to see and nice to be a part of. So I actually really enjoyed the tour.
Well, you did mention the fact that, you know, people have read your book now and want to talk to you, and that's something unique since this is your first book. But, you know, people have spent, you know, a long time with the book. It's 500 and some pages, so, you know, we're talking about...
I'm sorry, say that again. It's getting sort of loud here.
Sorry. Marisha Pessel is talking to us from the site of a wild party that she's attending.
I was on the film set of Special Topics Notes.
I was saying that, you know...
Hey, hello, Tom. Yeah. Just kidding.
The people who have read your book have spent, you know, 30 hours with you talking to them in their head, and now they get to meet you.
I know. Well, I hope I don't disappoint in person. I mean, yeah, because they have had this experience, and, I mean, I think it's funny now that I go back and work on my second novel. Now that I've met my readers face-to-face, I just have this extra sort of hope that I can deliver a great story to them again, because you just want to make it worth our while.
You know, I think when I was reading Special Topics in Calamity Physics, I think at some point, and I don't want to say this to scare you or intimidate you, but as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, this is just a massive work of, like, how could anybody top this? How could there be a second novel? But, I mean, I'm hoping that there'll be 50, but what's going on? What will be the second novel? Can you tell us a little bit?
I can't, but I don't see it that way. I mean, I think if you make the commitment to be an artist and you are allowed to have that be your full-time career, you understand that you're going to be releasing art into the marketplace. It's going to have a different reception, and but it's your duty to not look in the past and to keep moving forward and trying to convey that human experience. And in all of its different iterations. And, so I don't see it that way. I think I see it more from a long-term career standpoint and just telling the story that I'm most passionate about at the time and remaining true to it and not cheating and being very detailed about creating that world and creating those characters.
Do you have stories rattling around in your head that you can't wait to tell, that you're thinking, oh, I know what my 10th novel will be?
I definitely have a few stories, definitely, all at the same time. It's just a question of which characters are the loudest that I have to pay attention to them. So so I do have a whole crowd, but I have to, you know, make them stand in line and wait their turn.
Uh-huh.
I do, actually.
And so you have, like, little outlines, or you just keep them in your head?
I'll definitely write them down because I tend to be very flighty sometimes, and I'll think I have, I have this great idea that I wake up in the middle of the night with, and I'll be like, oh, that's so great, I'll definitely remember it, and of course I never do.
Right.
So
right.
I do have to write everything down.
You have something by your bed that you write?
I do. I have one of those moleskin notebooks, which I'm addicted to, and so I have a large pile of them around the house, really. So, no, it's good. Any fledgling writer or any writer, you just write it down, because at least I know I won't remember it. So it's important to always have that pen and paper.
And did you journal your whole life from the time you were 6 when you started writing? Did you keep a journal all that time?
Oh, gosh, no.
No?
Well, this is the reason why I write fiction, is because I try to spend as much time focusing on someone else's story, not my own. I've never wanted to keep a journal.
No.
I'd rather just experience life in that moment and keep moving forward and never look back.
Have you ever seen a movie based on a book that you read that you thought the movie was better than the book? Or do you think books are always better than the movie?
Well, I really like that movie, The Notebook. But I never actually read the book.
Oh, well, then it doesn't count.
I like Ryan Gosling a lot.
The Notebook was good.
Let me think. Why, do you have something in mind?
No, I mean, I just wonder because, you know, in Special Topics, it's obvious that you love books,
mm-hmm.
although, like you say, you made a lot of the books up. And it's obvious that you love movies.
Right.
So you love good stories.
I do. I do. And I love movies because there's that visual aspect to storytelling, and there's such power in a single image that sometimes I feel, you know, all the words in the world could not convey the power of a single startling image. So I really appreciate just the visual aspect of storytelling with film. But I think in terms of an adaptation, the key is to really, if you're adapting a book, to really create something entirely new, and it should be inspired by the book, but it should be its own entity. So I hope that is the case with Special Topics.
What about the book on tape? There's now an unabridged reading of Special Topics in Calamity Physics. Did you have anything to do with that, and how do you feel about that?
I don't know. I think it's fantastic because I grew up, my mother always read books out loud to my sister and I, and then we would read out loud to my grandmother. I mean, we always were reading out loud, so I just love listening to books aloud. I just like that. We chose a fantastic actress who's from North Carolina, and she does a fantastic job, actually. Really great.
My guest has been tonight Marisha Pessel, and her novel is called Special Topics in Calamity Physics, and you could read it or listen to it or... But don't wait for the movie, because the book is so great. And,
well, thank you.
And Marisha Pessel, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also find us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Marisha Pessel. Her new novel is called Night Film. We spoke about her first book, Special Topics in Calamity Physics. You should read them both because they're great. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.